All right. Welcome back for another installment of the Gopher Coffee Shop podcast. I'm Ryan Miller.
Brad Carlson.
And today we've got with us a special guest, Fabian Fernandez, who is a nutrient management specialist with the Department of Soil, Water, Climate in St. Paul. He also works with Extension. We're going to get to, you know, he's our first time guest, so we're going to get to learn a little bit about Fabian, his background. But before we do that, Fabian, you are, as far as Extension goes, probably most notorious for the two big conferences that occur every winter. I don't know if we're in year 10 with those, almost probably. The Nutrient Management Conference.
Might have actually predated him. Or the Nutrient Management Conference, I think, actually George Rehm, I think, started that, if I remember.
That's right.
I don't know if he started it while he was still here or if he started that right after he retired. I'd have to go back and look at the timeline.
Yeah, it definitely predates me. I've been here at the university for a little bit over 6 years now, and we are in the 12th, this coming up will be the 12th annual for the Nutrient Management Conference, and then the Nitrogen Conference is in its 6th year.
And that was yours, was your idea, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's kind of been more of the focus with some of the work you've been doing is the nitrogen and how nitrogen moves around in the environment and in our production fields.
Yeah, well, it's no secret that we've had a lot of issues related to nitrogen. I mean, that's a pretty big part of my job, you know, these days. And we were pretty fortunate that I think it was the Minnesota Corn Growers stepped up and helped provide some seed funding when we got Fabian hired because of all the issues related to nitrogen in Minnesota. And so that's what he was brought on board to do. And it's really been an asset to us. You know, we've got a really high functioning nutrient management group here in Minnesota, and boy, it's we were really glad to have poached you out of Illinois.
So, well, I'm glad to be here. I agree with you, Brad. I think we have a great team here at the University of Minnesota when it comes to nutrient management. There are so many expertise, so many people working in different areas. It's great to be part of that team.
Well, and part of it functioning so well is I think we all get along pretty well personally. We all like each other, and of course, I think everybody knows when you like your coworkers, you're going to get more done at work. So that's kind of how that goes.
That's right.
Big benefit there. So let's, I guess, take a step back, Bobby, and tell us a little bit of your background. You hail from the great country of Argentina, right?
That's right. I have a southern accent. I like to tell people from deep south, South America. So, yes, I was born and raised in the Pampas region of Argentina. And didn't grow up in a farm, but all my uncles farm, and they're about 20, 30 miles from where I grew up. And so I spent a lot of time in the farm. And then during secondary school, which basically 8th grade, 8th through 12th grade, I went to actually a technical school for agriculture. We have those in Argentina. And so you get to learn all the stuff that you would learn in a regular high school, plus a lot of classes, technical as well as practical classes on all sorts of agriculture aspects. So I loved agriculture always. And then I decided to come to the U.S. Actually, I didn't know any English. I came as a missionary for my church and to the U.S. to learn English here. And then decided, hey, you know, let's give it a try, see what it's like coming to college in the U.S. And so I got my bachelor's and master's at Brigham Young University. And then after that, went to Purdue for a Ph.D., and it's interesting because when I came to the U.S., I knew I wanted to do something with agriculture, but I didn't really know what. I took my first soils class, and I was thinking, boy, a whole semester of soils. What the teacher must be really just a creative person, because what's to talk about soils, you know, for a whole semester? And little did I know that I really loved the class, and then I knew I wanted to study soils at that point, and
it's funny, you know, as a soil scientist, you hear that from undergrads that they look at the possibility of taking a soils course, and they think it's probably really hard because, boy, you must have to get real technical in order to spend a whole semester talking just about soil. And in reality, there's so much you could talk about that you really can't get all that specific in a one semester intro to soils class.
That's right. And so, yeah, so I started with that and then took a soil fertility class. And it was like, to me, that was just it make perfect sense. I was like, yes, this is me. And so since then, I've just been focused in soil fertility, different aspects. But after my PhD, I worked as a faculty member in Illinois for 7 years. And I was primarily working with phosphorus and potassium, doing quite a bit of nitrogen work, but it was more not so focused in depth in that research. It was more like just for my extension program, to have data to help in my extension programming. And then, as we were talking earlier, I moved here almost 7 years ago with funding from the corn growers originally to study and focus my research and extension program in nitrogen.
I give the corn growers a lot of credit, and I think, you know, we're aware, we've talked about this before, that a chunk of the what pays for my salary also comes from the corn growers. Not that I'm on soft money, not that you are on soft money, but simply that they look at what they see as being important things moving forward and dealing with environmental issues, dealing with nitrogen in the environment and so forth, is a challenge to their industry as a whole, and corn production particularly, because corn is the major user of nitrogen. And, rather than be combative about it, they've decided to invest in it and work with the issue and find working solutions. And so that's what you're about. That's what I'm about. And we've done a lot of that stuff over the last 6, 8, 10 years. And I think we've really moved forward a lot as far as dealing with some of those issues. And today we wanted to talk about one of those issues that's been somewhat of a popular topic. We want to talk about urea. Urea is actually the most used nitrogen fertilizer in Minnesota. Not necessarily the case as you move across the Corn Belt, but there's a lot of things about urea that makes it a desirable product. Its dry form makes it kind of versatile as far as how we apply it and how we store it. Obviously, it's not perfect in that respect. It will take on moisture and get hard and so forth. But I think, as opposed to some of the alternatives, I think we recognize anhydrous ammonia has its particular problems. One being safety, mm-hmm. Two being the form that is present in as a gas or compressed liquid, as well as its temperature and the anhydrous nature of it, attracting itself to water. All kind of limits what we can do with anhydrous ammonia. And of course, then we look at products like UAN. 28%, 32%, well, that's 28% UAN, meaning the rest of us water. And, of course, the economics of moving water up and down the road and applying it to the field aren't real good. And
it does freeze in Minnesota, too.
And that, yeah.
So, we have issues with cold temperatures and right. Salting out, not having even some of those more concentrated forms of UAN right. Aren't real feasible from a cold exactly. Spring, cold that's weather right. Kind of storage issue.
Right. So that being said, urea is very popular in Minnesota, but there's been some disadvantages to urea that we've found lately, and a lot of your work has been focusing on that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Brad, in terms of what you said. Coming from Illinois, in Illinois, anhydrous ammonia is king. It's the number one fertilizer, and here in Minnesota, as you say, urea is really the number one fertilizer, and anhydrous ammonia has been losing ground fairly steadily over the last 10 or so years. And urea has some great benefits and great things going for it, as you mentioned. But a lot of the work that I am doing right now with it is trying to see how we can make it work for us agronomically. There are some definite benefits from anhydrous ammonia when we look at like fall applications of nitrogen. Anhydrous ammonia by itself, even without a nitrification inhibitor, is an inhibitor because it does kill the bacteria that is in the soil that transforms ammonium to nitrate. And so that keeps nitrogen in the ammonium form longer. Urea, on the other hand, is applied. It transforms very quickly within a couple of days to ammonium, and then once it's in the ammonium form, it can start to nitrify if the conditions are right, temperature and bacterial activity. And so for a fall application, it can be a lot more challenging. It's definitely a different, completely different source of nitrogen compared to anhydrous ammonia. And so that's kind of the thrust of what I'm doing right now with urea studies, looking at fall applications. We have best management practices for Minnesota. And for the western part of the state, we said that urea in the fall is a best management practice. It's an acceptable practice.
And for reference, western Minnesota, as our BMPs are defined, are more or less when you get west of U.S. Highway 71.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And so the other part to that, though, is since I came here to Minnesota, I don't think I have had a year where we didn't have really wet springs, excessively wet springs. Some of them, several of them, record-setting wet springs. And so the question is, are these BMPs that were developed, you know, 15, 20 years ago or more, are they still applicable given the weather conditions that we are experiencing? And so that's where we started looking at these questions of fall versus spring applications of urea.
Yeah, I know several years ago, I can't remember if it was before you started or maybe about the time you started, but somebody had tasked Jeff Vetch with looking at some of the research that went into making the BMPs as far as saying it was an acceptable practice in southwestern Minnesota. And for one thing, a lot of that was just simply based on the average rate of evapotranspiration in western Minnesota was higher than the rate of precipitation. So they said, you know, for the most part, more water goes up than goes down, and so it shouldn't matter what you apply. It's not going to go anywhere. But Jeff looked at the data from Lamberton back in the 60s when some of that research was done, and the comment he made to me, I don't know if he wants me to say this in public or not, but I'm going to say it because he said it, and I think it's germane to this conversation, is I'm not quite sure how they looked at this research data and decided that this was all right. Because it didn't really look that good back then either. I think the some of the thinking back then was they were still trying to convince farmers to fertilize at all. You know, average yields, 100 bushel corn was really good. So if you were off by 4%, it was 4 bushels. Now if you're off by 4%, it's 12 bushels, you know, or whatever, and so forth. And so they were just kind of using some different realities back then. That's when right. They interpreted that stuff versus today.
Well, and I just saw some information come out of Jeff and out of Waseca, so different from western Minnesota or southwestern Minnesota, but the last dry year we had was 2012 when we look at the climate norms. And so if you start thinking about modern history, or at least moving forward, if we're on this kind of trending pattern of heavier precipitation, it does kind of raise the question, you know, where was that at and where are things headed?
Yeah, and, you know, well, my first growing season here was 2013, and since then it's been extremely wet for many of those years. And yes, I did some of my own investigation in terms of the BMPs and where they came from, and, you know, and yes, I think it was a different time. I think the other part I always talk about when you know, discussing nitrogen, it's really a game of chance. You have to look at what is the probability that something will work. It will not work every time, you know, but how often? And when you look at the older data, because the western part of the state was drier than what we are experiencing now, well, you know, there were years probably where it worked okay. Some other years maybe didn't work so well. But there was no maybe a consistency. And so,
well, the other part of that is, as we talked about, you know, back then, most of the nitrogen application was anhydrous ammonia anyway. So it wasn't really, there weren't really all that many people even focused on it.
That's right.
But safety and some of the rule changes and things have kind of pushed people towards this urea world, and so that's what we hear a little bit when you're out in the field as far as decisions as far as a retailer.
Yeah,
you know, I've got more rules around anhydrous, and so I want to shift to urea, and so then they've kind of seen this BMP for Western Minnesota, and you know, now we're mentioning this fact that the precipitation patterns are changing, and you know, maybe the BMPs are changing too. Is what you're
Well, that could happen. You know, that we've got to, you know, we talked with Dan Kaiser on one of these podcasts a couple of episodes ago, and Dan talked a little bit about the formal process of changing the BMPs. We're not, because they're defined by statute in Minnesota, you know, we can't just come out and say, oh, well, we're going to do this now. They have to kind of go through the state rulemaking process and so forth. And so, it's enough of a impediment. You know, we as a university, the we, because Fabian, you and Dan particularly are the ones working most directly with this, need to make sure that we know exactly what we want before we go through that process. Because if we say, well, we got this a little bit different over here, or, you know, we, for instance, well, we didn't really look at banding with using Instinct, and we got to, you know, we wrote this knowing we needed to change again in 2 years. Well, we don't want to change in 2 years. We got to have everything all together before we go and change the best management practices.
That's exactly right. And, you know, we started this project looking at these questions with urea in the fall and different sources of nitrogen, different placement, things like that. In 2016, that was the first growing season, well, starting winter or fall of 2015. And I'm going through that process right now. I mean, it's an ongoing project. We are still collecting data, and I think we need a few more years of data because of this consistency. I think that's key. We need to look at across years and making sure that there is a consistency, or how much of a consistency to be certain that what we are going to recommend is adequate. And yeah, the data, you know, we are looking at the data in every possible direction, trying to make sure that we understand what is happening, you know, partitioning the data with wetter years versus drier years, looking at, you know, the temperatures, looking at the different soils that we have, trying to figure all these variables to see, okay, looking at cropping system, continuous corn versus corn soybean, do they differ? All of those questions are very, very important because, as Brad mentioned, this is we don't take these things lightly. I think they, you know, they impact what we do in agriculture in Minnesota, and so we want to make sure that when this is final, that we have strong evidence to make those changes.
So Brad, I think I'm thinking now of something. Your program, the Nitrogen Smart program, mm-hmm. One of the big goals with that is to kind of teach farmers to understand nitrogen cycling in the environment, and to kind of use some of their own observations and some of these things we were talking about with shifts in precipitation patterns and increased precipitation, and to outside of any formal changing of a BMP or a guideline, kind of using their own knowledge of these things to make some adaptations to how they're managing nitrogen. And so if we think about these changing precip patterns, you know, and if we have these abnormally wet years, where are we at with fall urea?
Well, Ryan, that's exactly right. And Fabian already mentioned the concept of a variable response, that one year it does one thing, one year it does another. I was first introduced to that decades ago, related to the side dress work that they did at Waseca. How often does side dressing pay for itself? And it wasn't very often. We're not here to talk in detail about side dress, but it does kind of come into play as far as if we look at various, whatever fertilizer practice it is, as Fabian says, it's not always going to work exactly the way we say. So then the question becomes, well, does it happen 4 out of 5, 9 out of 10? Is it 90%? Is it 80%? And so forth. And so the flip side of that is to understand when it doesn't work the way we think it's going to work, why?
Why?
And so a lot of that, because we're dealing with the environment, is just environmental conditions. And so that's one of the things that we stress with Nitrogen Smart, is understanding the dynamics whereby things don't behave the way that we think they should behave, and being able to flex your management based on what's happening in the environment. We need to, we can't afford to continue with a one size fits all.
That's right.
That this is the way we manage every acre every year. We really need to be more pragmatic. We need to be looking at environmental conditions and the options available at our disposal. Certainly, you need to have a plan as far as what you probably would do under most circumstances, but then we need to be able to be dynamic and flex it based on what the environment gives us. So now all the way back around to your question, where are we at with fall urea? Well, in general, if we just want to go back to what I talked about with Jeff Vetch saying that it seems that the recommendations were mostly made because we had higher rates of evapotranspiration than we had of precipitation. We've got higher rates of precipitation now than evapotranspiration. It set that on its head. And I know Fabian, you know, Dan Kaiser made a comment to me a couple of years ago, and I haven't seen anything to refute this, is he kind of suggested that probably we're still okay when we go in the Red River Valley of fall urea, but pretty much from about Morris south, the entire rest of the state, we probably should be just taking that off the table.
Yeah, that's exactly what the research that we are conducting is showing. And again, when we look at the consistency, you know, for the south central part of the state, we don't have fall urea has not been in the books. It has not been a part of the BMP simply because the conditions are just too wet in there. The loss is just too great. And we do have a location in Waseca for part of this study. And consistently, the data that we are collecting these last 4 years consistently has shown that what we knew already, that fall urea applications is just not a good idea because you are going to lose quite a bit of nitrogen. You will need more nitrogen, and you will end up with actually lower yields when you look at the economics at that optimum rate than you would with a spring application. And then you look at the, you know, southwest, west central part of the state, and on average, it's the same thing. We lose nitrogen in the fall. We need more nitrogen. If we do a fall application, you end up having to apply more nitrogen to actually produce lower yields. But there are those nuances that are very important to look at, and that's the part where it takes time and it takes years of doing this kind of research, not just a couple of growing seasons, where we are, you know, looking at the different cropping system, corn versus corn soybean. Looking at the weather, how much rain we got in the spring, how much rain we got in the fall, what kind of temperatures we had, trying to partition the data into those pieces so that we can better understand where it works or where it doesn't. And so, you know, for the south central part of the state, I feel very confident making an average because it's consistent. There is no inconsistency in all of that data. For the others, I think it's more important to start kind of looking and seeing, okay, what is the chance that this will work or not work? You know, out of 5 years, out of 10 years, how often you would expect this to be a good thing to do?
So I'm maybe going to put you a little bit on the spot here because I'm going to ask you to try and remember some exact numbers. But I know you've thrown some numbers at me. Dan's thrown some numbers at me. If we look at a best management practice, a recommended rate of nitrogen, and we go to the Southwest Research and Outreach Center in Lamberton, so if we apply that recommended rate of nitrogen as urea in the fall versus applying it in the springtime, how much yield reduction are we seeing for corn following corn and corn following soybeans using recommended rates?
Yeah, so again, you are definitely putting me in the spot. I can never remember numbers.
Uh-oh.
But not that well. But you know, you lose, I think it's about 14 bushels or so, 14 to 15 bushels, somewhere in there. You know, if you're looking at that same rate, the optimum rate, fall versus spring, you lose about, you know, 14, 15 bushels of yield at that. And so it's pretty substantial, and some years is more than that. I mean, in the database that we have right now, there being somewhere is, you know, like 40 bushel.
40, right. Yeah. That's what I remember seeing, is there was somewhere it was a 40 bushel. Yeah. And I know we'll get producers will say, well, my dealer says that this is okay. You know, and we talked about this on our nutrient management podcast, you know, my input of that is so your dealer says it's okay, we're telling you it's not okay. Do you want to invest in a practice where we're arguing about whether it's okay, or do you want to invest in a practice where nobody's arguing?
That's right. And that's, I think that is a very important point. You know, when I look at this shift, because it really has been a shift of anhydrous urea here in Minnesota, I see that is business as usual. We just changed the rate, changed the source. And that is very problematic because, like I say, when we started talking about it, urea and anhydrous ammonia are not the same. They are extremely different. I mean, if we're talking of a spring application or even a side dress application, okay, that's maybe, you know, closer. But for a fall application, they are so different that we cannot continue to do the same thing we were doing with anhydrous and just change the source and continue to do the same thing.
So let's put ourselves on a farm in western Minnesota. It's fall. We put on some urea. What is the fate of that urea? If we have a kind of a warmer fall with more than normal precipitation, what's the process? Can you walk us through how that is going to be lost?
Yeah, so the first thing that happens to urea, it's a large molecule. It transforms really quickly to ammonium. Within a couple of days, you will get pretty much all of the urea that you apply into ammonium.
But it's worth mentioning that if it rains right away, it's going to dissolve in water before that ever happens.
That's right, yeah. So urea, when you apply it, is extremely soluble. You know, just like nitrate will move with water. Like if there is excess water and it's that water is draining, if it rains right after that application, urea will leach just like nitrate would leach. And so that's the first thing. And then, you know, but once it's transformed to ammonium within a couple of days, a few days, then the process of nitrification starts. The bacteria will transform that ammonium into nitrate. And that's where one of the huge difference lies between anhydrous ammonia and urea. For anhydrous ammonia, because that application basically kills the bacteria in that retention zone of ammonia, you have no nitrification happening for a while, whereas with urea, that process, if the temperatures are warm, there is adequate moisture, which is typical in the fall, that process of nitrification begins right away. And then what happens to that nitrate really depends on two factors. One is how much water you have after it's nitrate, and the type of soil. So if you have a soil that is well-drained, either because it's naturally well-drained or because it's heavily tiled, you can get quite a bit of that nitrate leaching. If it's a finer texture soil with poor drainage and you have excess water, you start getting denitrification, so where nitrogen starts to go off to the atmosphere.
And it's worth noting, when you get into southwestern Minnesota, we have soil textures, particularly when we get down to Rock and Pipestone County, we're getting into the Missouri River watershed. We actually have lush soils down there that are somewhat similar to the soils we have in southeastern Minnesota. Not as wet, but probably just as vulnerable for leaching, mm-hmm. As those lush soils in the southeastern part of the state with as wet as it's been. You know, we're even looking at, in those soil types, whether we shouldn't be looking at not applying any fall nitrogen because of soil texture, mm-hmm. not just urea. So we got that going on too.
That's true. And, you know, the interesting thing is we normally talk about spring conditions are the ones that normally drive most of the loss. But it's not unusual anymore to see really wet conditions in the fall, you know. Kind of interesting, just as an interesting note, when I came here, I started at a drainage study in Lamberton. And some of my colleagues here in the department say, well, you'll have years where there will be no drainage. And so far, every year there have been drainage. And not only in the spring, but in the fall. And sometimes we actually have flooding conditions in the middle of the summer. And so, you know, spring still, I think, the main source of loss, because at that point urea will be 100% of that will be nitrate, and so it will be susceptible to loss. But even in the fall, especially if we apply it too early, you can get some of that nitrate, that on urea transformed to nitrate, that it's subject to loss.
And this is anecdotal, But based on personal experience, you know, the other thing that's happening is it's freezing a lot later. So we're not only is it wet and we're getting drainage. I know, like at the SROC a couple of years ago, they had water flowing through the tile lines until the 26th of December, which was just unheard of. Growing up as a teenager and a young adult, I did a lot of trapping. And because of that, you get really in tune with when things freeze, when the ground is frozen and your traps freeze in. And so you kind of stick in your mind about, you know, exactly when this becomes a real problem. But consistently through the 80s and into the 90s, you know, we were typically getting that hard frozen ground the first or second week in November. And I know, I mean, now it's, I mean, it's well, mostly the first week of December instead. So it's almost, it's 3 weeks to a month later than it's been.
Yeah. And being an avid ice fisherman, you know, that early ice is tough to find.
And oh, for sure.
Used to be like one of the better times to go fishing, but now with small kids, I can't really, from a safety standpoint, be bringing around unquestionable ice.
No. And that's right.
So yeah. We definitely are staying warmer. Mm-hmm. Later into early winter.
And it's leading to drainage that's happening through our farm fields and through our tile an extra month that we didn't used to have.
That's right. I've seen the same thing in western Minnesota where we've seen drainage happening right before Christmas. And which, again, I haven't been here that long, but people that have been here, they say this is extremely unusual. I just hope that we continue to have long winters because I like to have the break. Otherwise, we are in the field all year round, you know. That's one of the benefits of moving to Minnesota, that the winter season, you don't have to be out in the field doing field work.
A good benefit, yeah. So let's bring it to spring and spring applications. So in the southeast part of Minnesota where I reside, that's our BMP. We do spring pre-plant application nitrogen for corn. So that's what we live by. And, another practice that's, you know, gained some popularity is this side dressing. And typically we will see a top dress with a side dress application timing. So they're spreading urea, that first part of June. And there's a lot of confusion around safeners. People just throw the safener word out, and you know what are they talking about? Because we got different products that do different things with the urea molecule and mm-hmm. helping to protect that from loss. And so, you know, a year like this year, you're a little less cautious, I guess. If you're going to go do a top dress application, you can spin it on, and if it's like the weather this year, we're going to get rainfall within, you know, 24, 48 hours of that application. And so that helps to incorporate it. But in years where we get, you know, some lack of precipitation or the extended forecast is for some dry conditions, people will typically add your urease inhibitor. And there's, you know, name brand stuff now. There's some generic options. But
just apply it and go cut hay.
Apply it and go cut hay. So, you know, not as risk averse. I look at an investment if we're doing a side dress application, typically probably 60 to 80 pounds of nitrogen, and you're upwards of 40, 50 cents a pound for urea. And, you know, some of these products are pretty cheap with, you know, you can $7, you can kind of protect that $40, $50 investment and make sure that it's not going to evaporate, you know, because that is one of the major losses. But maybe we want to talk a little bit about safeners because that word's thrown around and it can mean different things.
Yeah, the first thing to keep in mind is for a side dress application, what you're looking at that point, you're not concerned about nitrification. You actually want that product to nitrify and be available for the crops to take it up. What you're concerned about is volatilization loss. You leave it on the surface, and the urease enzyme that is in the soils, especially where if you have a lot of residue on the surface, especially important, it will basically get that nitrogen volatilizing pretty quickly. And so having those that urease inhibitor with the application is important, especially if you know from the forecast that you're not going to get rain for several days. But that's about it, you know, in terms of other inhibitors, I would not worry about it. The other thing that some people have asked me, and I have actually done some research on that, is with, you know, polymer-coated ureas, for instance, to minimize the potential for volatilization. Well, that's problematic because that product will release very slowly, and you don't want that at that point. You want something that will be readily available for the plants. And so, a urease inhibitor is what you need to be looking at if you're not incorporating or injecting somehow that fertilizer. And then the other thing that is important is that there are a lot of products right now with a urease inhibitor, and not every product is the same. I mean, I'm not going to be naming names, but some products have just a trace of a urease inhibitor, and they're being called urease inhibitors, and they have no efficacy. And so, you know, that adage of, you know, what you, you know, if it's too hard to believe, probably true. When it comes to prices, if it's too cheap, too inexpensive, probably there is a reason for that. And so be aware of that.
So important as a farmer, if you're in that you want to be risk averse and you're looking at the precip pattern, and we're going to have dry conditions, you're doing the top dress application, ask questions and make sure you're getting a urease inhibitor and not one of these combination products or something that doesn't have very much, because as you say,
that's right. Well, for instance, I mean, just you name a product just simply because it has both, you know, Agrotain or Super U has both a urease and a nitrification inhibitor. Well, the only thing you really need from that product is the Agrotain, is the urease inhibitor. And so if you see a price differential, you know, go for what you actually need. Don't use the others.
Well, it's important to remember, too, that that the urease inhibitor prevents it from volatilizing and blowing away. So, you know, I had a farmer come up to me at FarmFest a few years ago and tell me that he was given free Agrotain. And I said, okay, well, how are you applying your urea? And he said, well, I put it on with my strip-till unit. And I said, well, it's a good thing it was free, because it doesn't do anything. You already applied that below the surface, and it really was no value. So it's also important to keep straight exactly what is you're trying to accomplish with that. Mm-hmm. Let's on the topic of that, though, Fabian, I do want to backtrack a little bit. You've been looking at the issue of banded versus broadcast urea, and we will occasionally hear farmers say that, I can put on a urea in the fall if I band it. What's your research showing on that?
Yeah, so there is no a total consistency on that, but there have been situations where it actually improves the efficiency of that fertilizer as a banded compared to a broadcast and incorporated application. And so I would say it's not going to hurt anything, but not every year you will get that consistent benefit out of a subsurface band application. And the same thing is true in terms of a nitrification inhibitor. You know, when we apply an inhibitor, what we are treating is not the product, but the soil, the bacteria that is in the soil. And so when you're broadcast and incorporating a fertilizer, you're basically exposing it to a lot more soil than you would in a band application. And so we are looking at that question with a nitrification inhibitor in a subsurface band versus broadcast and incorporated. And again, we are not seeing consistency, but there have been a couple of times where it actually improved things in a pretty nice way. I mean, you know, several bushels of yield increase over the broadcast and incorporated.
So, in essence, what you're saying is when all is said and done, it is possible that we may still consider, for instance, a strip-till application, banding urea in the fall in western Minnesota. That could be acceptable under some circumstances, probably pending what environmental conditions are like, but it probably does get back to what we talked about earlier, being a little bit pragmatic with thinking about what the environmental conditions are and whether that still works or not under those circumstances.
And the biggest challenge, though, I kind of get that same question with anhydrous ammonia, with the strip till and anhydrous ammonia, and it's possible, but the challenge that I find is that the ideal conditions for strip till typically are not the ideal conditions for nitrogen application. That strip till tends to happen, the ideal conditions tend to happen earlier in the fall when it's warmer.
Right.
And if you wait until the temperatures get cold enough for nitrogen, then sometimes you are not under the best ideal conditions for strip tilling. Yeah. So that's the challenge there.
Well, you guys have anything else you want to talk about?
Well, we've covered a lot of ground.
So we do want to make mention, though. We were talking about at the very beginning of the podcast, the Nutrient Management Conference and the Nitrogen Management Conference. They're both occurring again this winter, and maybe you want to throw us out the dates and locations for those.
Yeah, so the first one is the Nutrient Management Conference. That will be February 4th in Mankato. And then on February 18th will be the Nitrogen Conference, and that will be in Alexandria.
And we'll have links to those details on the blurb that gets posted with this podcast. So.
Yep.
And with that, we want to thank our special guest, Fabian. And we're signing off. Thanks for listening.